about interviews anyway. It's really, really not about one person. It's about relationship. And I guess the difference that I see, and I'll just start this, the difference between an interview and a conversation with someone who you're just talking with in a bar or whatever is that in an interview you know what the purpose is of the conversation. But having said that, what I'd like to do is I'd like, you know, you to talk about, you know, what you do and what you'd like to discuss about interviews, and then we can just sort of craft something that works for all of our purposes here. So I'll introduce myself last, so since you know my name already. So whoever wants to jump in, then go for it.
My name is Scott Carrier. I'm an independent radio producer and writer from Salt Lake City, Utah. And I started in producing radio stories in 1983 for All Things Considered, an NPR program. And mainly what I do is interview people. So that's how I start my stories, collect tape from interviews and then figure out how to make a story out of it. That's why I was interested in this group. Want to go on or no? That's enough.
No. I mean, just, you know, don't put too many limits on yourself. You pretty much know. I mean, I find about group dynamics is usually we know when to stop, and I don't tend to put really arbitrary lines on people because I just find that, you know, if we're all sensitive to each other, then it's like it all comes out right. Sort of like a potluck dinner, you know. So you can always test the group dynamic by seeing if you get a good mix of everything that arrives.
Or whether you get 20 salads.
Yeah, that's a sign that maybe you better talk to each other a little bit more before. So who wants to jump in next?
My name is Rebecca Singh, and I'm primarily an actor. Usually on the end of being interviewed. But I had an experience. I was working in a theater in Germany last year and was interested in sort of collecting, like it was just a really unique experience, so I wanted to collect the stories of the people there. So I found myself becoming an interviewer. and I'm interested in this because I guess just because of my background, I know how to spin things, you know, I know how to interview for the purpose of selling kind of thing. Like, my show is so great because, you know, but yeah, I find that sometimes when it's more of a interview in terms of, when it's not to promote something, I get confused, so, and I'm just interested in, like, you know, I get confused by the format simply because I've mostly had to promote something. So
you've been on the receiving end of you've been the interviewer.
Yeah.
Which is a different experience, yes.
My name is Stephen Naylor. I define myself mostly as an electroacoustic composer and sound designer. I live in the East Coast, Halifax. And I created a piece a few years ago in which I interviewed a couple people. It was a scripted piece with a lot of abstract material, acousmatic material, but I interviewed a couple people, and that was a bit of a challenge. I found that, you know, I did get what I needed for the piece, but it was interesting how it came up against my limits. And I'm one of the commissions for pieces for the festival, or for the conference, or some combo of the two. And I was, because the commission is from CBC, I was steered fairly strongly towards a journey and more of a narrative than I would instinctively do. And again, I came up against that limitation when I was trying to interview other people for my piece, realizing that my sensitivity to the whole notion of how to conduct that kind of conducted conversation was relatively limited. So I'm really here in this group to try to get a better sense of how people approach it and what some of the challenges and nuances are, to be a facilitator of a directed conversation.
I'm James Cotter. I work at CFRC 101.9 in Kingston.
James, could you speak up just a little bit louder?
Sorry. I work at a campus community radio station in Kingston. Been doing campus community radio stuff for a few years, so I spent a lot of time interviewing people and really interested in it. I'm
22?
22, yeah.
Yeah?
Wow.
So, yeah. And,
I haven't been there that long. Only 3 weeks.
My name's Chris. I'm at the Sea of Mercy. And I think I'm most interested in this workshop because I've done a show on like kind of like the psychology of music, so it's a lot of people, and I found that I really take into the long form interview, and that's a very exciting thing to explore. But I noticed that there's a certain point where I kind of drop the questions, and a little like person inside of me who's interested in what I'm discussing with the person take over, and it always becomes a much better interview listening to it afterwards. So kind of wondering if there's a more structured way to go about kind of not just going off your gut instincts, but to steer the direction of the interview. But I'm also really interested in cutting interviews and the editing process. I find that's a big thing.
Okay, I'm sure we got a lot going here to get a lot of discussion going, and it's like that's why I thought I'm not going to play any examples, because this is really, for me, in thinking about what I wanted to do with this workshop, I thought what the approach that I thought of was to go over how my ideas about interviewing have changed over the course of a lot of years, from just a few more years than yours, but you know, likewise, I started out in 1976 at a campus community radio station in Windsor that wasn't even on the air yet. These were in the days when we were dreaming of going FM, and I think we were doing like 10 years of practice, you know, before then. And I was most interested in radio, not because I wanted to do news, not because I wanted to do disc shows, but because I could sense there were creative possibilities here. I started out wanting to, first of all, be a composer. I really wanted to be a composer when I was 14 or 15. Turns out I had become one, but not in the way that I thought that I was going to. I wanted to be a conductor, so I stayed very rooted in music. Then I joined a theater company, and I did some music for theater productions. It was going to be music and theater. But I found radio, and it's like, I can do all these things on the air. And that was what was really exciting about it. But because radio is still, in many ways, really stuck in a sort of like, we talk and we play other people's music. And that hasn't really changed an awful lot over the whole length of radio. And the whole, and this is why I love this conference, is because we do get to branch out and we talk about what are the other possibilities. But my very first interview, it was for a program called Mosaic. Nice and generic, you can do anything. So the program director of our tiny station said, do you want to go do an interview? And I think it was with the Dixie Flyers, the bluegrass band. So I said, how do I do an interview? And he says, you just go take a tape recorder and ask questions. And that was all of the instruction I got in doing interviews up until that point. So I went out and I asked questions. And I think I did some prep beforehand. You know, I had enough. Nobody taught me how to do this, but I kind of thought, I got to know what I'm talking about here. So I did some research, and so I had some ideas about who they were, but it wasn't a very structured interview. Then I got back to the station. I say, okay, here it is. What do you do with it now? And so he showed me how to dub it over on the reel-to-reel, and he said, and now you edit it. And I went, what's that about? He said, well, you take a razor blade, you take this tape, and you just cut out the bits you don't want. So that was really... That is, I think, the essence of interviewing and cutting interviews, is you ask questions and you cut out the bits you don't want. So at the very, very basic, that's where I started. After that, it was like the same year or so, and we all decided that we wanted to get jobs in radio, and we figured the best way to do it is to set up a radio week where we interview people from radio stations all over Windsor. And this is at the end of the heyday of the Big Eight. CKLW, so everybody wanted CKLW, which those of you who don't know CKLW, it was like the largest, one of the third largest American stations on the continent, beamed all the way down to Kentucky, and it's like they had a directional antenna that went right across the lake. They didn't care about Canada. CRTC regulations came in and they said, nope, you're going to be a Canadian station if you're going to be here. And they brought in CanCon regulations, and some people say that's what killed the Big Eight. But there's a very good documentary about that done by a Windsor filmmaker, which is fascinating listening and viewing. So, turns out nobody wanted CBC because they all wanted the pop stations. So, and I had been a CBC listener sort of because my grandmother was always a CBC listener, so I knew what CBC was about and everything. And so it turns out I'm the only one that got the job, which is really nice. So I then did a feature Saturday mornings on CBC Radio for 2 years, and I also became a summer relief technician, and so I did a lot of technical work at CBC too. And so it's like my history has been like both in public radio and also in community radio, because when I moved to Vancouver in 1982, I discovered Vancouver Co-op Radio. And at Vancouver Co-op Radio, the spoken word was supreme. It was about, I mean, it's been really, really a huge influence in my life, but it was like radio can accomplish things. It can bring communities together. It can bring people together. And so, and at the same time, they had applied for a Canada Council grant to do a sound art show. And that's when my questions, we were talking about what is sound art, I had to differentiate this and make this application work to create something which was acceptable to media arts that didn't duplicate Musica Nova, which was the contemporary music show. And so this is where I started asking the question, what is sound art? But to get back to my ideas about interviews, in those very early days when people said, yes, you just ask questions. And yes, that is true, but I realized along the way, and I think pretty quickly, that you had to have a reason for asking those questions. And the type of interview that you do, I find really, really depends on what kind of information you want and what you want to accomplish through the interview. So I think that in terms of the structure of the interview, it varies depending on what your purpose is, but that's always where I start, is what do I want to get from this person? What is the purpose of this conversation? Is it going to be part of a documentary? Is it going to be live? Is it going to be edited after the fact? But where it really started to change for me as far as my exploration into the interview form, at a certain point, I realized, okay, we can do a very quick interview, which is like, you know, your typical go grab the clip, put it in your documentary, or your 5 to 7 minute interview where you're trying to get information, like the promotional kind of interview and that kind of thing. And that has its purpose. You know, in the morning, you can't talk a long time about things. You can't get into a lot of detail. So that's one type of interview. And then there are other ones, like the real shift came for me when I was, I started working about 10 years ago on a series on international development where we're talking about different issues having to do with sustainability and peace and environments. And some people, we were getting into some really, really, you know, kind of deeper ideas, almost philosophical kinds of things, where my idea about what I wanted to do with my interviews really shifted. Was I was doing a series called Children of the Earth, and it was about children and the effects of poverty and war. I'm sitting there in a group where I was really kind of nervous, quite nervous about it, because I was talking to a group of kids, and I'm going to stop using the word interviewing now, and I'm going to start using the word talking, because really an interview is about talking, and the interview format is something artificial sometimes that I think we put on top of that, and then it makes it seem very technical. And so I'm sitting there, and I knew it was going to be difficult. I had arranged the interview through an immigration and settlement organization in the city where I was living, because it's like you just can't go down the street and just say, hello, can you help me find somebody, some kid who grew up in wartime conditions who I can talk to? You know, and the thing is, too, there's some real issues involved with that, too, because these are traumatic conditions. And so I did not, even if I did know somebody who I could sit and talk to, I didn't want to do it without an intermediary, because I really felt like I needed that person's advice. And I was really glad I had it, because we're sitting around the table and these kids are talking about, you know, one little girl is talking about, she's from Bosnia. She said, I went and sold my doll so that I could buy a present for my sister for her birthday. You know, stories like this. And the point where I went, where do I go with this, was when one young Somali boy sat there and he talked very, very matter-of-factly about the day that he watched his best friend getting blown up by a landmine. And at that point, it's like, it's almost like I froze because I thought, where do I take this? You know, because I didn't want to be exploitative and get into the sort of tell me all the gory details. That was not going to help, and also it wouldn't help him. And I'm getting more into this whole idea that an interview is not about me just going in and grabbing something. It's about respecting where that person is at and helping them bring forward their story too. Doesn't necessarily work that way with politicians, but I don't do interviews with politicians anymore, so I mean, different strategies are required for them. But so this boy, I'm thinking, do I ask a follow-up question? Do I ask him, does he want to talk about this? Did he bring it up because he really wants to talk about it? And if so, I didn't want to shut down the discussion. But I didn't want to keep it going and push him past his comfort level either, because first of all, it's like the whole traumatic memory thing. It's like that can open up a whole can of worms that I was not prepared to do. And that's why I'm really glad that the youth counselor who set this up was right there too, just in case something like that happened. But it's like, I just realized, am I capable of getting into the real depth with people that I really think I would like to go with my stories right now? And I'm no longer really content to keep things on the surface. And so I've been asking a lot of questions about how to establish relationship with people. And in terms of establishing relationship, I think it's something that, you know, even if you are going in to get a quick answer from someone, or if it's a long conversation where you just really want to keep it flowing, what do we do to create those conditions where the person we're talking to will bring out what it is that they want to bring out? And there are instances, too, where you want them to bring out things that they don't want to bring out, but that is the whole political interview and things like that, and people who have agendas that they want to defend and things like that. That's really not where my journalism is going right now, and I just got back from Central America. My current project right now is, you probably know of it, Chris, the Green Planet Monitor? Yeah, so Green Planet Monitor is, I've been working on it with a good friend of mine, Dave Kattenberg from the Prairies, and we get funding from CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency, to do stories on sustainable development. And sustainable development, we don't mean just in the narrow environmental sense, but a sustainable like societies, sustainable sort of ways of living, you know, in general. And so it was an interesting way of trying out just how to build relationship in that kind of setting too, because I went to Central America and I was working through a translator. So how do you develop trust between and dialogue between someone when you don't even speak the same language and you have an intermediary? But yet at the same time, I mean, I think relating to someone and being able to get them, I mean, they're talking to you because we're talking about the kind of interview now where I am, where they're talking to you because they want to share something. So how do we work with them to do something, you know, to create the conditions so that they can share? How do we respect their boundaries? How do we know what their boundaries are? How do we not be so conservative? My big issue a lot of the times is I want to back off sometimes when somebody comes up with something really personal, and it's just like, maybe they wouldn't be saying this if, you know, if they, you know, if I was more forthcoming with them. But there have been times too. I was in India a few years ago with the last Green Planet Monitor series, and I was in Kashmir, which is do you know the whole, and Kashmir right now, it's disputed territory between India and Pakistan. It's militarized. It is dangerous. You know, it's dangerous. I mean, I felt some danger myself, but I felt danger from the people I was talking to, and I made a point a couple of times of saying to the person I was talking to, are you sure that this is okay for me to, you know, do you really want me putting your words on the air? On the internet, the Indian government can, you know, he says, yes, I want you to use my words. He says, I am used to dealing with this dynamic all the time. It is important for me that people out there know what's going on. But I felt like I had to do that because I just would have backed right off and not asked him the questions that he maybe did want to be asked. And so, but it's like, it's also being aware of people's vulnerability. I remember I worked with Out Front in 2003 at CBC, which was an amazing, you know, phase of my life. And it's one of the things that, you know, I look at, and I mean, working with Steve Wadhams, for example, was like going to a master class every day. I mean, I worship at the feet of the master. But there were times people would send us pitches where they're talking about, well, I want to talk about being an illegal immigrant. And there were times when we said, no, you know, it's like, you don't want to do that. You know, that's putting yourself at risk. And there were times, too, because Out Front is about personal storytelling, we got some pitches from people who were in a great deal of pain. You know, and this was the hard thing about it, is to look at it and you're saying, how do we validate them as a person? And for me, this is really what it's all about now. It's about how do we validate their experience as a person and also try and help them take this where they want to go, but yet at the same time, maybe it's not a good place for them to go. So it's sort of, I guess I've become more like a, you know, somebody said to me, they said, you know, you're really not a broadcaster anymore, you're also a social worker. And I went, yeah, maybe, but that's a role that I want and a role that I like. So this is the direction that my explorations have gone. And the other thing is too, there's a site you might want to look up when you're looking up, you know, I guess the question of, you know, first of all, as media people, we want to feel like we do some good, and we also need to feel like, you know, we also need to do no harm. And in traumatic situations, we can do a great deal of harm. There's a site that I really recommend that you go to. Do you know the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma?
No.
It's an American site that has really, really amazing resources on how, as journalists, to work in traumatic situations. Like, it can be anything from, you know, dealing with somebody who, you know, is talking about, you know, the breakdown of a marriage, for example. You know, small, you know, things that are small traumas in the context of looking at earthquakes and things like that, all the way from car accidents to, you know, earthquakes. And it's like, what kinds of things, you know, can we do? Like, what happens when we arrive at the scene and we're the first person to arrive after a car has crashed and there are people, like, in hysterics all the way around us? So the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma has some really, really amazing resources. And also, too, it also has some good resources for us as journalists so that we can look at our own responses, because it's like we do pretty well as far as an industry not, you know, being affected by, you know, post-traumatic stress and depression and anxiety and things like that. I'm really amazed at considering how many situations that we find ourselves in that are, you know, extremely difficult. But there are self-help resources there too that says, okay, you've just come back from a car accident and you can't sleep. You know, it's like, what do you do in order to help yourself through that? And I think getting in touch with ourselves also helps us get in touch with the person sitting across from us. And it's about building, for me, it's about building authentic relationship, no matter who you're talking to. So having said that, then setting the scene, I just, you know, let's talk about what you want to know about, ideas that might have sparked, ideas you have of your own.
You're talking about interviewing the children from war zones, and I've always had trouble with the idea of aestheticizing people, because when you turn something into, even if it's a news piece, you're putting an aesthetic framework on top of what you're being given as raw material. And I don't know, how have you found, like, with trying to build authentic relationships and trying to validate people's experiences, like, I don't know, how have you bridged that aesthetic gap, turning somebody's experience into a piece?
Can you give us an example of maybe a piece that you've struggled with? That
How did you even realize that? You're pretty young. How did you come up with that? Where did that come from?
In particular, actually, I found it really came in relationship with, like, print media and stuff. And in particular, there was a book by David Eggers called What is the What?
Okay.
And David Eggers has a very heavy-handed aesthetic style. And it troubled me that there was this sort of very privileged, middle-class, well-educated person, and he didn't profit financially off this book. He gave all the funds to whatever, but he was telling the story of a friend of his who was a child soldier. And in reading that and in reading other newspaper articles and stuff, it becomes clear how people aestheticize these kinds of things. And I started thinking about when I was interviewing people and the stuff I was doing. And I've never really had the opportunity to interview anybody who's in a serious situation like that. I haven't had to personally sort of deal with it, but I was like very conscious of like worrying about it.
What makes you nervous? What is it about that makes you worried?
It changes the focus of how other people see, like reception, I guess, audience.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that even if you were to just simply have a conversation and cut tape, that you're creating an aesthetic construct?
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's...
So to me, your question is not so much about the problem of aestheticizing an interview as to what extent does your intervention in it become your aesthetic as opposed to information. And I think, I've come from exactly the opposite, that I've come from an aesthetic background, now trying to incorporate perhaps more concrete, factual, informative material. So for me, it's almost a matter of how can I not let this content overwhelm my aesthetic.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
it's not an answer. That's probably another question.
Yeah.
Well, the other side of the same question.
Yeah, there are always a lot of conundrums. Has anybody? Have you ever experienced?
I know what you're talking about, for sure. I'm wondering, so what are you, how do you think the right way to do it is?
I don't know.
But what have you come up with? You must have wondered about it, how to do it the right way.
I'm very young.
Right.
You pointed that out.
Yes, yes. I know, but that's why I'm so interested.
I don't know. I it's just a problem.
My take on it, which is, again, from a totally different point of view, is that you're already on the track by asking the question.
Yeah.
And that you're approaching it with a perspective that's already valuable and is going to inform the way you create your work. And as long as you keep that perspective, then you're going to be just fine.
Sort of, Chris, you're going to say?
Well, I don't know. I mean, perhaps one idea would be how much do you let the interviewee in on the process?
Yeah.
It is their story, right? Like, I can imagine, or how we see interviews that happen, you go in with a very focused idea of what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You get more than that, you edit all that out, and you get the story you want, right? Or the interview you want. But, you know, there's also the idea of letting the person being interviewed in on the process, like, not just asking, like, how do you want this done, but, like, it's almost a collaboration.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when I went to Central America, this is the first time I'd ever been an embedded journalist. You know, and I traveled with an NGO, and so they were helping me set up the interviews and things like that. So in a lot of ways, I had to work my agenda so that it worked along with theirs. And that worked fine, because I knew the organization, I trusted them, I knew what I was going to get. But it's like I find when I was in that process, the whole idea about how much of their story do you want to tell, sometimes they don't know what you want. So it's like sometimes they'll veer off in different directions. And this is where shaping the interview and the whole research process at first to know what do you want to get from the story is also part of the dance too, because you want to give them the space to say what they want, but yet at the same time, if they don't know what shape you're thinking, then they may take it in directions that don't work for you. In fact, they probably will. And so my tension when I'm doing interviews sometimes is they'll get off on a tangent where I know I've got, like, I'm cutting this into documentary form. But, and so I have certain answers that I need. But yet at the same time, even if it was like an interview that, you know, you don't want something that meanders all over the place, that unless it's a personality interview where you're exploring ideas with the person and you can let it flow all over the place. But so what I found myself doing sometimes, you know, the person would want to talk about one thing, but I needed them to talk about something else. I think that accepting, for me, it's accepting that, yes, I am the author of this piece. I know what I need. I know what my production requirements are. And in terms of timing, and I mean, I love collaborative journalism. And the thing is, that's more and more of what I want to do, is work with people developing their own story, like the Out Front kind of model. But with Out Front too, it was often I found myself asking, who's telling the story really? Because on the Out Front kind of formula was, you're telling your story. Well, it isn't. The producer and at Out Front, they dedicated 6 entire days of the producer's time to produce one 15-minute story. So it's like that producer is heavily involved in that. It's also well produced. So it's like there's an awful lot of shaping that's going on. And so I think in some ways, as much as I loved Out Front, and I think that it's really a show which I just think would be great if we could just keep going. And I think we can, and it, you know, maybe not on CBC, but it's like, as a producer, when I'm working with the person at Out Front, am I being really, really honest by saying, this is your story? Because they put in a proposal. We judge whether or not we want that story. We take a look at that proposal and we underline it and we go, this is interesting. Oh, not so much. No, they're kind of meandering here. So let's focus on this. Then we get back to them and we say, well, this is what we hear in your story that would make a really compelling documentary. So we're shaping them every way from Sunday all the way through the process. And there were cases too when generally the way it's supposed to go is, before it goes on the air, the person gets to listen to the piece and go, I like that, I don't like that, I wish you could change that kind of thing. Sometimes, just because of time constraints, we weren't able to do that. So sometimes the story did go on the air without even the final vet by the person who did the story. So it's like the collaborative process is, it takes a huge, huge, huge amount of time. And in the rush to get things on the air, we sometimes cut corners. And this is where I think the whole, we're putting a form on something that, you know, didn't exist before, but there are very, very definite limitations on what we can do, given that we don't have months and months to work on a piece.
I had an experience doing an interview, which was really difficult for me in that it was, so I live here in this building, and one of the requirements is that you have to be an artist, and you have to be, it's rent geared to income, so you have to be basically low income. And when the building opened a year and a half ago, there were all these interviews about how green it is and how artistic it is and all this kind of thing, right? And so I agreed to do an interview with Radio Canada, which was a bit of a challenge for me because I don't speak French very often anymore, so I was a little nervous about it. But the reporter came over to my place, and I was under the understanding it was going to be about a 3-minute piece, and you know, was asking me sort of a few questions about what it's like and all this kind of stuff, and I was doing my best to answer them, and she clearly only had about 10 minutes of time because she didn't eat lunch or whatever the situation was, so we were in a rush, and then she asked the question, well, why are you poor?
Oh.
And that's an impossible question to answer when you know that the piece is going to be 3 minutes long. Like, at least I felt, I was like, I don't have any idea how to answer this, because I know, I felt like that was just a really difficult thing for me, because I didn't feel like there was integrity behind that question.
Uh-huh.
Like, I was like, well, I'd be happy to sort of talk to you about it, but this isn't the right context. And so I just kind of, like, what do you say at that point, you know? Like, so I had to go against what I would normally do, and I was like, well, because I'm involved in the arts and it's hard to get funding in Canada, like, you know, so in terms of that, like, I think that if it had been a different context and if we had more time, like, you know, that would have been a fine question and we could have kind of gone there. But with the constraints, like with the situation that it was like, it just made it really, like, I don't know, I felt like it was just really an unanswerable question. And then even though I did answer it with a short answer, it was like a betrayal of my own personal beliefs, you know.
Yep.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that I said here, this is an example of sometimes I try not to interrupt, but sometimes when I'm steering an interview, I hear something that I just want. So what I'm doing is I'm shaping the interview just as we're talking here too. So, but one thing that you said that I would really like to follow up on, because I think it's really germane to our discussion here. You see, the other thing that I'm doing here is I'm recognizing that I'm the person who's directing this discussion, and that's what an interviewer does. And I think we can't be too shy about that, because that is our job, and as uncomfortable as it is, it's just like, you know, you're a director. It's like being a theater director or a music director or conductor or whatever. That's your job. But getting back to what I heard there is lack of integrity. And you skirted away from that after that, and then you came back to your response, but what was that about as far as your feelings of the integrity issue?
Well, my feelings, I guess I have to just speak from the perspective which I know best, which is I can do the marketing thing to a certain extent. So I can talk about, I can talk in the direction that the interview is going, you know, for the public that might be interested, you know, so in that case I can, you know, I know that I'm speaking to a small a small group of French speakers in Toronto or whatever, I think for me, like I don't want to, when it comes to more serious questions, like there's some questions that you just need time to answer, and there's some things that I can't spin, like I don't want to spin, I don't think, you know, it's like if like, because it's in the arts, and it's not a corporate thing, so you don't have a media spokesperson to go to, like the interviewer doesn't have a media spokesperson who's going to be on message, etc., and so on. So I often find myself having to be on message, but then also having to be like a real person, you know, and so that real person part of it is important to me, but sometimes it's not the right thing for the format of the interview, but there's really a push all the time to get a real piece of you, you know, to get something, you know, real and not fake, and so it becomes just a very difficult negotiation, I guess, because I have my own sort of, yeah, like I don't want to spin who I am and how I got to where I am. So it's my own integrity in that too.
So it's your own integrity, but you said it's your own integrity too. I'm wondering, getting back to the point of view of the person who was doing the interview, because
yeah,
we're approaching this from the point of view of the person doing the interview here, was there an integrity issue that you felt with her by bringing that up? Her own integrity?
Well, I guess I don't know how to put it other than I don't think it was a fair question.
Okay, that's good. And the thing is, I think that, you know, being in touch with those kinds of responses and the way that we feel when someone asks something of us that we feel was a violation, that can give us clues as far as how not to do that. Because when you first said that, you know, when I was horrified that anybody would do that. And I know that they do that, but that's the kind of thing that is just like, it's a relationship burner, you know, when it comes to, you know, really, really, I mean, putting a person on the spot like that. She was trying to make a story out of the story that you were not expecting.
She might not have been. That's the problem.
Yeah, okay.
It may be. Here's the other thing.
Yeah.
I think we've come to the whole question of how do you phrase questions?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she may have simply, I don't, you know, I'm speculating purely, of course, but she may have simply had curiosity about, you know, artists and the state of artists and the economic life of artists. Or she may have had a question about, you know, how income levels relate to the building and your feeling about all that, and just simply totally screwed it up in the way she asked it.
Yeah, like it could have been if it was prefaced by, you know, obviously we know that being an artist isn't a well-paying, you know, thing, you know, what is it? Like, it could have been a different question, and I think it would have really.
And that
did
leads to the whole question
of skill.
Setup.
Yeah, and skill and setup and that kind of thing. Because she didn't get from you. My sense is she did not get from you what she wanted. So therefore, what happened was it was her way of relating to you that stopped the discussion instead of moving it forth. And I think that that's the thing when we're doing an interview, regardless of what we want to get from a person, we have to be very, you know, very aware that there are certain ways that get people to come forth, and there are ones that just slam down the door. And that was a good example of the door slam, I think. But anybody else have any other examples of interviews that either you think that really opened the door or really shut it that maybe we could discuss? Scott, you're not. You've done so many interviews.
Yeah,
I'd really like to draw on your expertise here too.
Well, I think it's kind of always a wild thing. It's unpredictable. I think language is a wild thing, and so I never really know what's going to happen. And often I don't know why it happened afterwards. But it's mainly a problem of getting the person to open up. And like, if she asked that question first thing, did she ask that first thing?
No, but she only had 10 minutes, so we were only talking for about...
Yeah, I think to ask a question like that, you kind of have to develop some relationship with first in order not to turn the person off. But I think people are always like, well, what do you want? Why are you doing this? Who are you, and what are you doing, and why are you talking to me? And if you can clear that one, that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it easy to say. I can say all of that usually in less than 15 seconds or 10 seconds. And then it's mainly just whether they want to talk to me or not. Whether they, more is going on than just the words. They're looking at me, I'm looking at them, they're sizing me up. It's like smoking each other. And I think I can tell pretty quickly if the person's going to open up or say something, or if the person is interesting. A lot of times people just don't have anything interesting to say.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I think of it as like fishing, like fly fishing. You throw the line in a lot of water a lot of times, and only a small percentage you actually catch it or get a hit. And so I just go through a lot of people to find someone who's willing to open up and then has something interesting to say. And I think of it as like, a photographer taking a portrait. Try to get a good portrait of a person in sound instead of visually.
And that raises a good thing to talk about too, getting back to craft here, and that's the pre-interview. It's like I didn't want to do, first you do your research, then you do your pre-interview, then you do your interview. But the pre-interview is really, really important because you don't want to waste their time, you don't want to waste your time. And so, like, for example, as far as the structure of the interview, I use, when I was working with, live on-air current affairs shows, like Radio Noon, when it was Radio Noon at CBC, what we would do is, here's the process, and this is for a 7-minute current affairs interview style thing. So you start in the morning with the story meeting, you come up with all these ideas, okay, everybody has 5 story ideas, and usually, the rest of the group has 1 or 2 of them. Then after that, you talk about the approach and everything like that. And then you have to actually get the people on the phone. And you essentially do the interview before you do the interview. And when it's live radio, it's like those people, on the air that are sounding like that they're so knowledgeable. The way that the scripts were to be done at CBC, it's probably still the same way now, is that the host is involved in the process. They're there at the story meeting, but the thing is they don't do the research. What they do is it's you write your scripts and your questions and everything in such a way that if that person was late and showed up 5 minutes before going to air, they can take those questions and that background and they can sound like they've been researching the story for 2 or 3 weeks. And so our jobs were to call the person who we wanted to do the story with and not just listen to for what kind of knowledge they can impart, but also, are they going to be good on the air? And the only time when I had a host that just wanted to kill me, and it's like, this was like a big, it was a great story. It was actually from the city where I live right now in Hamilton, where it's sort of like, you need speed limits for scooters in Hamilton. We have a lot of disabled people and they have electric scooters and you can get one over in the mall by those things. It's nuts. So there was this guy who was saying we really, really need to do driver's tests for scooters. you know, and I thought, this is a really, really good story. And I listened to him on, you know, I talked to him on the phone and everything, and it should have occurred to me that this guy, if he was putting me to sleep when I was talking to him on the phone, he's going to put the host to sleep too. But I went ahead with it anyway because I thought it was a really, really great story, and oh, he was awful. And so the host came up to me and said, don't ever do that to me again. So, and that was the kind of thing where I was only thinking of how great a story it was. You know, what I could have done is I could have found other people to talk to instead of him. I mean, he was very, very convinced that he was right, but there was no passion in his voice. He spoke very slowly. And it's like, it doesn't work. So it's also the tone of voice. It has to do with their knowledge. It has to do with a whole bunch of things. And the rule for current affairs interviewing, which is much different from personality interviewing, or when you're doing an exploratory kind of thing, like when I'm doing, you know, sort of idea-oriented interviews where I really want the person to dig in and talk about philosophically where they're coming from, I'll let the thing run for half an hour to three quarters of an hour because I know I'll get those nuggets if I just let it evolve. With a current affairs interview, you got to get to the chase really fast. You got to get in. You got to get out. So what I do as far as the questions, I do the pre-interview. I figure out what I want from this person. And my questions are like a roadmap. And even when I do questions for myself, I still know how I wanted to start. I know how I wanted to end. I'll give myself some questions in the middle because also, do you ever have the kind of experience happening where you're right into the middle of a really, really great thought, you're really, really with it, and all of a sudden it comes to an end and you go, what do I ask now? And that still happens. So it's like to have that in front of you where you don't want to keep, you know, looking at your questions and reading them, but if you know that there are certain talking points you want to bring up, but you know how you want it to end, you know what you want to get out of it. You start by saying, this is the purpose of my interview. Like, if you're doing a host interview, you might say, you know, few people, you know, think of it very often when you're in a shopping mall that you could get run over and hurt very badly by a motorized scooter. But you have one coming at you, you know, 20 kilometers an hour or so, and it's like, and you have to jump out of the way. You know darn well. That is the reason why you're doing that interview. To say, this is a danger issue. Then you get into the details around it. And then at the end, what conclusions do we want to draw from this? And so it's sort of like bringing everything to a nice wrap at the end. And even if you're doing something which is going to be edited later, it's always good too for the person you're interviewing to be able to sense when things are coming to a close because the tone changes, the energy changes. And so it's like, I guess, you know, the best thing is by getting out there and doing a lot of interviews, you pick up on a lot of this stuff, and that's probably the best way to learn about doing interviews is just to do lots of them. How's our time getting to be, by the way?
It's 35.
Okay, that's great. So we have another, what time is lunch supposed to be?
Noon. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so that's good. That was sort of like I was kind of sensing the energy of the group and, you know, we're taught. And this is the same thing, especially when you're on the air live. It's like, you've got to be able to pace that conversation so that you get out of it what you want to. But I'm interested, Stephen, in your experiences as a musician going out and doing interviews and how the difference and similarities between being a musician and being a more verbal sound person.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm also very text-oriented as well. I mean, I'm a, you know, one of these wannabe writers who, closet writers as well. So there's always that in the back of my mind. And also, my interviews have never been current affairs. They, the ones I've done, and literally, I could say I've done half a dozen.
Okay.
Literally, that's it. So I'm very much at the beginning point of trying to incorporate that kind of material in my work. But I'm very, well, it's more, no more than half a dozen. I did it. But I haven't done a lot. And I think because my focus has been always to take this material and reshape it later, and reshape it usually in a musical kind of context, that there's always, it's very liberating, because I don't really care about, I have no preconceptions except that we cover the topics that I want.
Can you tell us about the topics and about the people you interviewed and how you used it?
The first one I did was, I was commissioned by Two New Hours to do a radiophonic piece that was a portrait of a composer who had been absolutely pivotal to the new music scene in Nova Scotia.
Who is that?
His name was Steve Tittle, and he now lives, he's moved to BC. He was teaching at a university, founded a new music series, an amazing guy.
Which university?
Dalhousie. He was at Dalhousie for about 20 years. And he also played in a group that I was involved with. So I had to interview him in my studio. He was also, coincidentally, my neighbor. I played in a band with him. I studied with him for a year. You know, we were pretty close. And I had to interview him and get him to talk about himself, but also about this world that he created. And it was so informal. He came into my studio, you know, we drank beer, drank coffee, and I just recorded him sitting there in a workspace like he knew very well. And the real problem with that was the stories were infinite.
They were.
The stories went on forever.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And
yeah.
And of course, I also had to I made the mistake of deciding a priori that I would transcribe everything he said, and then I would look at it that way rather than working through the material.
Uh-huh.
And it was an absolute nightmare, although in the end I got some great stuff.
Yeah.
But I was shocked at how, I won't say it got it away from me, because I didn't ever imagine I was going to control it.
Yeah.
But from that I learned that quantity of material can utterly overwhelm you. And I was trying to produce, you know, a 40-minute piece, a fairly long piece, but still. And it was my first experience, you know, was definitely an eye-opener. I didn't do anything again for about 10 years.
You said something really interesting, the whole issue about you hadn't intended to control it. And I think that's really a difference between how we do interviews is how much control do we need over the process. And that is also, that's determined by length, is determined by deadline, is determined by a whole bunch of things. And so some things, like a personality interview, you don't want to control it too much because you control the beauty and the life out of it.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, there are some kinds of things where, you know, you hand an interview to a politician and let them control it? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Not good. Yeah, not good. So, but...
But the next ones I did, but I did this radio piece that... it's sort of about life on the street, but it's not... It's very... it's fictionalized, but and very abstracted. I'm mostly dealing with the overwhelming urban soundscape is really what the piece is about.
Mm-hmm.
But from the potential perspective of someone who's exposed to it all the time, whether by choice or by necessity. And I interviewed two urban planners, as well as my fictional narrator character at the center of it. And there I came with very directed questions. And I recognized that they both had an institutional role to protect. And my goal was to get them to go beyond that.
Yeah, good.
And it was wonderful. I got really beautiful personal statements from
them. How did you do that?
Well, in one case, I knew the person reasonably well, you know, with family connections. And I think he was immediately willing to suspend his corporate sensibility. And I think I just simply followed. Once I saw an opening, I simply followed it. In the other case, it was interesting. It's like he wanted to do it. So I can't claim any skill at all. It's just I was lucky that I had two interviewees who were willing to both present their official stance on the materials engineering and urban planning and urban design, and then get down into their own personal response. And I suppose I probably directed the conversation.
You helped create that environment.
Yeah,
and that's the thing is we do create the environment.
But it was very easy to do. And because I came with questions, and I think my pre-interview was much better than it was in the first case, in the end, of course, there's always way too much stuff, and I'm, you know, essentially reducing it to snippets rather than an extended interview. But it was a much more satisfactory process, and the end result was no more, no less satisfactory, but the process was a lot less overwhelming for me.
You know, as far as how much material to gather and being overwhelmed, and are you familiar with the Radio Features Group? They're a group of radio producers mostly based out of Europe, who've been getting together now for 25 to 30 years, and it's almost like a little cult. It's really, they're very intense about what they do, and they'll do things like, for example, there's one piece that came out of it, right out of Denmark, I think, and there was a woman and a man and their dog. And what they did was, the producer, for some reason, got this idea that he wanted to explore how each one of them related to the dog, like separately from each other. So sort of using the dog as this kind of way of getting at their personalities. So what he did was months and months and months and months of recordings with a microphone with people separate. Well, what came out of it was when the woman was with the dog, or when the man was with the dog, he was like the hunting dog, and it was like his male buddy and everything, and they're going out there and they're hunting in the bush. And the woman, when she's with the dog, she almost infantilized the dog, you know, making it like a baby almost. And the thing is, when they heard each other's interviews, it's like a huge fight broke out. And it's like, how dare you treat my dog that way? And it's like, you know, and it's so, and he got all of this on tape. But this is the aesthetic of the radio features producers. One person, there was a conference in Toronto in 2003 that I was able to go to. And usually they hold them in like Zagreb, you know, like all over the place. But it's about 65 or 70 people who've been meeting together for a long time, including Steve Wadhams, who works with Outfront. He's a big radio features person. But one person who was talking about, the amount of material, and he was saying for 1 hour of finished radio, he gathers 30 hours of material.
It's like,
it is. Yeah, it is. But the thing is, a lot of these, the people who are doing the radio features kind of thing are quite spontaneous in their approach, where it's sort of like they'll set up microphones and they don't know what they're going to get. And so that's like kind of the exploratory approach to radio, which I really quite love in a lot of ways. And you sort of let the drama evolve. And then there's the really tightly current affairs where the worst example, I mean, this is something that I would never do, but it's kind of like an extreme example of how I think not to do radio. I was doing some training with a person who did a lot of news radio, and he really, really thought the pre-interview was, well, when you're doing news, yes, you want to know what you're getting because your deadlines are so tight. You don't have any, you know, any time to really to waste. So what he would do is he would interview somebody on the phone. He would go out. He would have a script pretty much written before he went out to do the interview, and he would go and he would know what clips he wanted, and he would ask the question again that he asked on the phone. And if he didn't get the answer which would fit with his script, he would say, well, excuse me, can we do that again? And this is the way you said it on the phone. Can you please do it again that way? And I went, oh, no, no. I'd throw the microphone at the guy. And we had quite a few fights over that, because they say, you're rehearsing them. You know, and what you're doing is sort of he's actually a very fine journalist. I mean, he was quite young at that point. It was probably, he was trying to make a point, I would think, that you have to be prepared and structured and everything. But it's like the person going down the street and going, you know, well, did you get the story about the Parliament buildings burning down? Well, no, I went by it, but I had to do my other story. So it's the kind of thing, you know, where it's like you can't be so planned that you really, really miss, you know, a curve. But yet at the same time, the thing is with the amorphous, you know, let's see where it goes kind of thing, that can be really, really beautiful. And the structuring after the fact can be a really wonderful process. And when I do my own art pieces, that's what I do, is I'll go for a walk with my microphone and I don't know what I'll get. And I'll just like let it soak in. And today is like some of the things that came up for me while I was watching the presentation this morning, for example, was there's a piece that I want to do based on a mountaintop in the Ottawa Valley. Well, hilltop, not mountains, but anyway, and it was a former Pine Line installation, which the Pine Line was one down from the Dew Line. And here's this pristine, beautiful place in the middle of nowhere. Everybody thinks that they're totally cut off from the rest of the world. And I have a clip where somebody says, yeah, and there's the name of Foymont on a missile in Vladivostok pointing directly at us. And that was my inspiration for this piece that I want to do, which we were doing sound art up there too. I did an audio art camp for quite a few years, or 4 or 5 years, at 1999 to 2003, and I really want to do it again. Because what it was a gathering of people who love sound, and Darren Copeland was one of our artists in residence, and a bunch of other names that you would probably recognize. And we got together in the bush, and we created art. Some of it was musical, some of it was documentary. It was sort of all over the place, but it was a wonderful time. I'd love to do it again, but that's where this Foymont thing happened. And we actually did some improvs on the top of this mountain in this decaying military, you know, infrastructure. And I thought of that, but certain things came up, like, for example, where he was talking about, just grab my notes for a minute, because because my mind was just buzzing all over the place. And this is where your mind buzzing all over the place can be a really wonderful thing. And when you're doing an interview with somebody, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to, to destroy that, but you still, you got work you need to do too. But things like, for example, Bemused, the ballistic missile early warning system. I'm thinking, there's a poem here to be bemused. Oh, this is just such a contrast. And things like McLuhan saying Canada is hidden ground for the big powers. It's completely, you know, on target with what I'm doing. So, and it's that kind of receptivity. Whether you're talking to someone or you're listening to someone at a panel discussion, this is where art and journalism really differ, I think, because as artists, we can give ourselves the space to explore all of these tangents all over the place. And that's why a lot of my work, like, I guess the way that I'm describing my work right now is documentary poetry, where what it is, I love that line between subjective and objective, and you're playing back and forth so that, you know, it's more like, the way I describe it sometimes is what I aspire to do, and I hope I do it in my piece. It's what would happen if you took a journalist and a poet, asked them to cover the same event, and then locked them in a room and said, you have to come up with a piece you can both agree with. That is my aesthetic. And that's why the whole thing about combining with music, and it's like my next incarnation, too, is I actually want to start working with live musicians. And the sound about Foymont, for example, I hear the voices of Kennedy and Brezhnev there. I hear the sound of, you know, the beautiful northern woods. I hear the sounds of us playing on these old, you know, military things that are falling apart and everything. And I hear all these voices and all of this scary stuff, you know, that is influencing this life there without people even knowing that it's influencing their life there, because we're just thinking it brings jobs. You know, so it's the exploration, I think, that's really, really exciting about the work that we do. And that's what really, really fires me up about it. And I just got to get more. I've been doing a lot of journalism, so I need to switch over to the other side.
I have to give you a little quotation from George Lewis. You at a conference that I was at, someone asked him, no, he was talking about sound art, the sound art question. I think Darren actually brought it up, the sound art question. Mm-hmm. And George Lewis was talking about how sound art is viewed by visual art galleries, and he said it's viewed as the crazy uncle in the basement.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought it was so apt that,
yep,
that we're trying to make this work that we don't even know quite how to define it or where it's going to go and what's going to emerge when it comes out of the basement. You know, whether it's going to be have wear a journalism hat or a musical hat or just some lunatic thing.
Well, you know, the way I explain it to people when it's sort of that there have been some, you know, audio art and sound art really doesn't have a tradition because we come out of a whole bunch of different traditions. And so it's like 20 some years ago in the early 80s, 30 years ago, when the first question, you know, okay, so produce a show about audio art, well, what the hell is it? You know, that's where it started. But what I realized, and Hank Bull, who anyway is also, you know, he's, I don't think his piece is going to be played tonight, but it was supposed to be. Anyway, Hank told me, he says, really, this is something which exists between disciplines. And it's like people may have an idea when they're 9 or 10 that they want to be a visual artist, or they may want to be a journalist, or they may want to be a musician. But what about people who are interested in the sound of all those things? And this is where the audio art camp was really, really exciting, was because we had visual artists who came. We had poets. We had actors and actresses. We had documentarians. And it's like, it's where we all meet in the middle and learn from each other. And the visual artists, talk about the crazy people in the basement. It's like, for me, coming from radio and music as well, more radio especially is a very, very, very time-bound medium. And it's like the tyranny of the clock is something that we just kind of internalize. We never, ever question it. Well, I was doing a series a few years ago. Actually, it's this series right here. I still have some copies of this left, so if anybody would be interested, I could probably part with my copy, and I can bring some more tomorrow. This is a series of that I did about 10 years ago on the work of 10 Canadian audio artists, and it was for play on community radio stations. So I hope you still have your copy in Kingston.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So I did two different editions, 20 different artists, and I remember Michael Waterman, who was like a crazy man of the visual and, you know, and sound art world, I said to him, well, the piece has to be, I put a framework on it, I said it has to be 28 minutes long and 20 minutes of artwork and 8 to 10 minutes of contextualization, because I had people who were saying, well, I just want to play artworks. But it's like, that doesn't really work on radio, because when people turn it on, they go, what the hell is this? We're so, people, when people turn on the radio, they're used to hearing certain things. So I think it's really, really important to be, it's like those little plaques that they put in the art gallery that explains what the work is about. That's what the 8 to 10 minutes was. So, and I had a lot of artists who really resisted that. They said, I want the work to just speak for itself. And I'm going, nope, not on the radio. Not going to happen. So, but Michael was telling me, he said, I can't do it in half an hour. I said, well, you don't have to do it in half an hour because it's 28 minutes. So, anyway, he's going, but my piece takes longer than that. And I said, well, sorry, this is radio. And this is the time, and it's like if I sent it out to stations and they were all different lengths, it would never get scheduled because everything runs in half hour blocks. So anyway, I said to him, well, would you do a painting for an art gallery that you couldn't get in the door? And he went, yeah, maybe. But you know, Michael raised so many questions about my ideas about what radio is and time and everything, that it's like getting together in that kind of environment where somebody can go, but wait, you know, look at it this way. And that was what's really, really fruitful and really productive about that space, was because we had a chance to get together and work out these things, you know, in a big expansive area where, you know, we're out in the middle of the woods and we don't have anywhere to go. It's like I deliberately set it outside of the city so that nobody could be distracted by the internet pop or anything like that. Or, oh, I have to get home, I have to check my, you know. This was pre-internet days almost too, because it was 1999 when I started it. 2003, we had internet hookups to the rest of the world. So it'd be very, it's a somewhat different experience, but if anybody would be interested in coming to something like that, I think I'm going to get it going again for next year. Canada Council was, you know, right there with it right from the very beginning. So we, it was a wonderful time. And I'd love to do it in Nova Scotia, because it's like I've got friends down there who are always saying, you know.
No, there are some really interesting possibilities for places to do it.
For
well.
Sure. No, it's 5-2 and it's hot. So anyway, James and Rebecca, we haven't heard too much from both of you. Is there anything that, you know, that you've been meaning to say or would like to bring up? And
I don't know the industry stuff so much, because I listen to CBC and I don't produce radio, but yeah, it's interesting to hear about. That sounds like a cool